The inner sanctum. He ushered her into the room at the end. Excuse the mess. I must really get round to tidying up in here one of these days. My wife used to... He broke off abruptly, and he glanced at the silver-framed photograph of a family group on his desk. Nicholas and a beautiful dark-haired woman sat on a picnic rug under the spreading branches of an oak. There were two little girls with them, and the family resemblance to the mother was strong in both of them. The youngest child sat on Nicholas's lap while the elder girl stood behind them, holding the reins of her Shetland pony. Ryan glanced sideways at him and saw the devastating sorrow in his eyes. So as not to embarrass him, she looked around the rest of the room, which was obviously his study and workshop. It was spacious and comfortable, a man's room, but it illustrated the contradictions of his character. The bookish scholar set against the man of action. Amongst the muddle of books and museum specimens lay fishing reels and a hardy split-cane salmon rod. On a row of wall hooks hung a barber jacket, a canvas shotgun slip, and a leather cartridge bag embossed with the initials NQH. She recognised some of the framed pictures on the walls. They were original 19th-century watercolours by the Scottish traveller, David Roberts, and others by Vivant Denon, who had accompanied Napoleon's L'Âme de l'Orient to Egypt. They were fascinating views of the monuments drawn before the excavations and restorations of more modern times. Nicholas went to the fireplace and threw a log on the fading coals. He kicked it until it flared up brightly and then beckoned her to stand in front of the floor-to-ceiling curtains that covered half of one wall. With a conjurous flourish, he pulled the tasseled cord that opened the curtains and exclaimed with satisfaction, "What do you make of that, then?" She studied the magnificent bas-relief frieze that was mounted on the wall. The detail was beautiful and the rendition magnificent, but she did not let her admiration show. Instead, she gave her opinion in offhand tones. "Sixth king of the Amorite dynasty, Hammurabi, about 1780 BC, she said, pretending to study the finely chiselled features of the ancient monarch. Before she went on, "Yes, probably from his palace site southwest of the ziggurat at Ashur. There should have been a pair of these friezes. They're worth in the region of $5 million US each. My guess is that they were stolen from the saintly ruler of modern Mesopotamia, Saddam Hussein, by two unprincipled rogues. I hear that the other one of the pair is at present in the collection of a certain Mr. Peter Walsh in Texas." He stared at her in astonishment, and then burst out laughing. "Oh, damn it! I swore Duryod to secrecy. But he must have told you about our naughty little escapade." It was the first time she'd heard him laugh. It seemed to come naturally to his lips, and she liked the sound of it, hearty and unaffected. "You're right about the present owner of the second frieze," he told her, still laughing. "But the price was $6 million, not five. Duryod also told me about your visit to the Tubesti Massif in Chad and southern Libya," she remarked. And he shook his head in mock contrition. "Well, it seems I have no secrets from you." He went to a tall armoire against the opposite wall. It was a magnificent piece of marquetry furniture, probably 17th-century French. He opened the double doors and said, "This is what Duryod and I brought back from Libya, without the consent of Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi." He took down one of the exquisite little bronzes and handed it to her. It was the figure of a mother nursing her infant, and it had a green patina of age. "Hannibal, son of Hamilcar Barca," he said, "about 203 BC. These were found by a band of Tuareg at one of his old camps on the Bagradas River in North Africa. Hannibal must have cached them there before his defeat by the Roman general Scipio. There were over 200 bronzes in the hoard, and I still have 50 of the best of them." "You sold the rest of them?" she asked, as she admired the statuette. There was disapproval in her tone as she went on, "How could you bear to part with something so beautiful?" He sighed unhappily. "Had to, I'm afraid. Very sad. But the expedition to retrieve them cost me a fortune. Had to cover expenses by selling some of the booty." He went to his desk and brought out a bottle of Laphroaig malt whiskey from the bottom drawer. He placed the bottle on the desk top and set two glasses beside it. "Can I tempt you?" he asked, but she shook her head. "Don't blame you. Even the Scots themselves admit this brew should only be drunk at sub-zero weather on the hill, in the 40-knot gale, after stalking and shooting a 10-point stag. May I offer you something a little more ladylike?"
"Do you have a Coke?" she suggested.
"Yes, but that really is bad for you. Even worse than Laphroaig. It's all that sugar. Absolute poison." She took the glass he brought to her and returned his toast with it. "To life," she agreed. And then she went on. "You are right. Duryea did tell me about these." She replaced the Punic bronze in the armoire and then came to face him at the desk. "It was also Duryea who sent me to see you. It was his dying instruction to me."
"Aha! So, none of this is coincidence, then. It seems I am the unwitting pawn in some deep and nefarious plot." He pointed to the chair facing the desk. "Sit," he ordered. "Tell."
He perched above her on the corner of the desk, with the whiskey glass in his right hand and with one long denim-clad leg swinging lazily as the tail of a resting leopard. Though he was smiling quizzically, he watched her face with a penetrating green gaze. She thought that it would be difficult to lie to this man. She took a deep breath. "Have you heard of an ancient Egyptian queen called Lostris, of the second intermediate period coexistent with the first Hyksos invasions?" He laughed a little derisively and stood up.
"Oh, now we're talking about the Book River God, are we?"
He went to the bookcase and brought down a copy. Although well thumbed, it was still in its dust jacket, and the cover illustration was a dreamy, surrealistic view in pastel shades of green and rose purple of the pyramids seen over water. He dropped it on the desk in front of her.
"Have you read it?" she asked.
"Yes," he nodded. "I read most of Wilbur Smith's stuff. He amuses me. He's shot here at Quentin Park a couple of times."
"You like lots of sex and violence in your reading, obviously,"
she pulled a face. "What did you think of this particular book?"
"I must admit that he had me fooled. Whilst I was reading it, I sort of wished that it might be based on fact. That was why I phoned Duryea."
Nicholas picked up the book again and flipped to the end of it.
"The author's note was convincing, but what I couldn't get out of my mind was the last sentence."
He read it aloud.
"Somewhere in the Abyssinian mountains near the source of the Blue Nile, the mummy of Tanus still lies in the unviolated tomb of Pharaoh Mamose."
Almost angrily, Nicholas threw the book down on the desk.
"My God, you'll never know how much I wanted it to be true. You'll never know how much I wanted a shot at Pharaoh Mamose's tomb. I had to speak to Duryea. When he assured me it was all a load of bunkum, I felt cheated. I had built up my expectations so high that I was bitterly disappointed."
"It's not bunkum," she contradicted him, and then corrected herself quickly. "Well, at least not all of it."
"I see. Duryea was lying to me, was he?"
"Not lying," she defended him hotly. "Just delaying the truth a little. He wasn't ready to tell you the whole story then. He didn't have the answers to all the questions that he knew you would ask. He was going to come to you when he was ready. Your name was at the top of the list of potential sponsors that he had drawn up."
"Duryea did not have the answers, but I suppose you do?"
He was smiling sceptically. "I was caught once. I'm not likely to fall for the same cock and bull a second time."
"The scrolls exist. Nine of them are still in the vaults at the Cairo Museum. I was the one who discovered them in the tomb of Queen Lostris."
Rayan opened her leather sling bag and rummaged around in it until she found a thin sheaf of glossy 6x4 colour photographs. She selected one and passed it to him.
"That is a shot of the rear wall of the tomb. You can just make out the alabaster jars in the niche. That was taken before we removed them."
"Nice picture, but it could have been taken anywhere." She ignored the remark and passed him another photograph. "The 10 scrolls in Duryea's workroom at the museum. You recognize the two men standing behind the bench?" He nodded. "Duryea and Wilbur Smith?" His sceptical expression had turned to one of doubt and bemusement.
"What the hell are you trying to tell me?"
"What the hell I am trying to tell you is that apart from a wide poetic license that the author took unto himself, all that he wrote in the book has at least some foundation in the truth. However, the scroll that most concerns us is the seventh, the one that was stolen by the men who murdered my husband."
Nicholas stood up and went to the fireplace. He threw on another log and bashed it viciously with the poker, as if to give release to his emotions. He spoke without turning around.
"What was the significance of that particular scroll, as opposed to the other nine?"
"It was the one that contained the account of Pharaoh Mamose's burial, and, we believe, directions that might enable us to find the site of the tomb."
"You believe, but you aren't certain."
He swung around to face her with the poker gripped like a weapon. In this mood he was frightening. His mouth was set in a tight, hard line, and his eyes glittered.
"Large parts of the seventh scroll are written in some sort of code, a series of cryptic verses. Duryat and I were in the process of deciphering these when..."
She broke off and drew a long breath. "When he was murdered."
"You must have a copy of something so valuable." He glared at her, so that she felt intimidated. She shook her head. "All the microfilm, all our notes, all of it was stolen along with the original scroll. Then whoever killed Duryat went back to our flat in Cairo and destroyed my PC onto which I had transposed all our research."
He threw the poker into the coal scuttle with a clatter and came back to the desk.
"So you have no evidence at all, nothing to prove that any of this is true."
"Nothing," she agreed,
"except what I have here." With a long, slim forefinger, she tapped her forehead. "I have a good memory."
He frowned and ran his fingers through his thick, curling hair.
"And so why did you come to me?"
"I have come to give you a shot at the tomb of Pharaoh Mamose," she told him simply.
"Do you want it?"
Suddenly his mood changed. He grinned like a naughty schoolboy. "At this moment, I cannot think of anything I want more."
"Then you and I will have to draw up some sort of working agreement," she told him, and she leaned forward in a businesslike manner. "First, let me tell you what I want, and then you can do the same." It was hard bargaining, and it was 1 a.m. when Royan admitted her exhaustion. "Oh, I can't think straight any more. Can we start again tomorrow morning?" They still had not reached an agreement.
"It's tomorrow morning already," he told her.
"But you are right. Thoughtless of me. You can sleep here. After all, we do have 27 bedrooms."
"No, thank you," she stood up. "I'll go on home."
"The road will be icy," he warned her.
Then he saw her determined expression and held up his hands in capitulation.
"All right, I won't insist. What time tomorrow?"
"I have a meeting with my lawyers at 10, but we should be finished by noon.
Why don't you and I have a working lunch here? I was supposed to be shooting at Ganton in the afternoon, but I'll cancel that. That way I'll have the afternoon and evening clear for you."